This is the Goalkeeper Roundtable, hosted by Dr. Bill Steffen, with Jeff Shook, George Costellas, and Dave LaTourette. Welcome back, everyone, and Happy New Year. We kick off season two of the Goalkeeper Roundtable by asking American goalkeeping icon John Bush to pull up a chair. John had a 20-year storied and rock-solid career as a professional player, but it wasn't easy at the start. We talk a bit about that career, but also his transition into coaching and a bit about his high-performance goalkeeping business side of things. We had a lot of fun chatting with John, and we hope you enjoy the conversation as well. So let's get it started with Dr. Bill, GK, Shooky, Lotto, and Bushy.
Here we go. Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever. Anyway, we've got another goalkeeper roundtable, and we're very happy to have John Bush with us. John's got a long career in a variety of actual professional outings, but obviously best known for his time in MLS. So also an upstate New York guy, so I'm happy about that. So, John, you know everybody here, so welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys, first of all. Appreciate it.
No. Happy to do it, man. We'll just start chat.
Billy, hold on. Before we start, it's another guest on the show, and I said this in our email thread the other day, but Jeff Shook continues to be the oddball in the group. He is the black duckling because this is midget goalkeeping. So four against one here, Shooky. We got you, brother.
Yeah.
Foot five and getting rained on first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd say something, but after we finish recording, I'll say something. John, maybe it's going to be helpful if you, I think, just give everybody just an overview of your career, okay, just so everybody understands where we're coming from.
Okay. So born in Queens, moved up and down the East Coast when I was young, settled back up in Albany, New York for about my high school years. Played for the under-17 national team, went to a world championship with them. Played for the under 20 national team. Didn't really get anywhere, so that was a quick cup of coffee. Played for the full national team, both under Bruce Arena and Bob Bradley, two different times. Went to UNC Charlotte, where I spent three wonderful years before I decided to chase that $1 million contract in American soccer, which I'm still looking for. Haven't found it yet, but then went from there, started in the old USISL, which is the USL now. Spent 5 years there, did a little up and back between the MLS and there for four out of those 5 years. And then finally got drafted by Columbus Crew full time. I think that was 2000 and either one or two. Spent 5 years there, then got sent to Chicago, 3 years in Chicago. Sent from Chicago to San Jose, 5 years in San Jose, back to Chicago for 1 year, then to Indianapolis, Indiana, for the Indy 11, which was a NASL team at that time. Spent 2 years here as a player coach, knowing that at some point, you know, I was getting late in my career that, you know, I wanted to get into it full time in the coaching side. So decided to leave the MLS at that point to get into this and do a player coaching role. So spent 2 years there and, retired here, actually retired as a Columbus Crew player, signed a one-day contract, retired there. And then we live in Indianapolis, Indiana, and this is where I coach now.
Yep, and what kind of what's your organizations now? Give yourself a plug, man.
Okay, so I have about, like all of us on this show, I got about nine different jobs. I coach for the Indy Fire Juniors, which is in MLS Next. Then I also coach at IUPUI part-time, both for the men's and women's. So I train their goalkeepers. I also have my own, goalkeeping academy called John Bush Goalkeeping, which I run that out of a facility called Sagility here. And I also own my own glove company called HPG, or High Performance Goalkeeping.
Ah,
I think that's everything I do.
Yeah. Hey, before I forget, let's circle back with that way you can plug your company too. But let's circle back a little bit with HBG and talk gloves later in the show.
Whenever you want.
Cool. All right. Jeff, go ahead, man. You got something.
So, John, you played in the USISL, the MLS, and the NASL. What were the differences between the leagues, and was one more challenging than the other? And doesn't have to be based on the MLS being higher in the food chain.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. You know, well, I think first and foremost, I need to backtrack and you know, kind of talk about Charlotte days with Eric Vauder. You know, and everybody on this show knows yeah. Eric, right? EV, as everybody knows him. EV is my second dad. And thank God, I mean, I've known him for whatever, 20, 30 years now, and he's my guy. Anytime I have an issue, a question, whatever, he's that guy. And I was very fortunate to come across him at UNC Charlotte. Just kind of stepped in it, as they say there. But he's the one that that kind of got me really going. I had ideas. I wanted to be a pro, you know, from playing with the youth national teams, and we'd go abroad and you'd see different clubs and different, but EV was the one that started having all these old USL, not old, but all these USL, USISL goalkeepers coming down, like Mike McGinty's, Jeff Dubacks, all these guys would come into Charlotte to train and during the winters to get ready for preseason. You know, and I remember my first freshman year in the winter kind of going like, who are these guys? Like, what's going on? And then I started realizing. So I remember saying to him, like after my freshman year, when they all went back to their teams for season, I said, hey, you know, that's what I want to do. I said, I don't know if I'll ever be good enough, you know, and I don't really know how the hell to get there. I said, but, you know, you obviously do, because, you know, at any time there were anywhere from 7 to 9 of these guys just driving into town for a night, you know, to train, and they go home and they come back the next night or whenever. So, you know, so that's kind of how it really started. We didn't talk about it much, but it was more of me seeing it and realizing like, hey, there might be something here. So going back to your question, I think, you know, the plan for EB, and he had the whole blueprint, thank God, you know, was for me not to go right into the MLS, because he knew I probably wouldn't last too long. He knew I needed games. And the best way he described it to me, because him and I grew up playing hockey up north, was, you know, in hockey, you start in the minor leagues and you work your way up. And so it was kind of the same idea where he wanted me to sign with the Greensboro Dynamo and start there, get my games, and then if I was good enough, eventually maybe somebody would sign me into the MLS. So, you know, we go to, you know, so I signed in Greensboro Dynamo. At that time, it was kind of tough, though, because they had Scotty Garlett going up and down from DC, who became an unbelievable goalkeeper, and you had Aiden Heaney, who was just coming back down from the refs. You know, so it was like, all right, I'm number three right now. But I was very fortunate. Those two both took me under their wings and kind of, yeah, again, because I'm 19. I think I'm king of the world. You know, I'm a pro goalkeeper. I realize now at 44, I was an idiot, you know, but you learn that as you get older. But it was great. You know, again, I was just happy to be there, you know, but I also think that, you know, and you guys know as well as I do, reality sets in, because that was the old days, right? That was when you played on a Friday night and drove all night on a bus and turned around and played Saturday night somewhere else, you know, and you got into the hotel at 3:30 in the morning and, you know, you stopped at a truck stop for dinner somewhere on the side of the road. By the way, kids, there were no cell phones. So you had to call your significant other using a payphone, calling collect usually. So, yeah, we won 2-1. I'm good. Bye. You know, and you do one of those. We've all done it. You know, but again, I was just happy to be there. I was a pro, you know, I didn't mind riding buses, doing all that stuff. You know, again, obviously MLS was the highest level. So, you know, you're flying everywhere. You got free Adidas gear all over the place, like all the things you could really want. You know, when I got to the NASL, I was at a point in my career where, I just had a decent year going back to Chicago, even though the team was terrible, but I played a lot. I felt good. I don't even remember what I was, 38, 39, somewhere in that ballpark. And I had two other MLS teams that were interested in me, you know, more as a backup and that sort of thing, but that was fine with me. But I started talking to a buddy who was playing here, Brad Ring, who played with me in San Jose, and he started telling me about Indy, and I knew about it because Jürgen Sommer was the original head coach, and Jürgen and I are buddies. So I knew a little bit about him, but the more I kind of researched it, and then Tim Hankinson became the coach. So he was the one that kind of really persuaded me. And it just kind of fit into where I wanted to go, you know, with my next step. So I sat in every coach's meeting. You know, I was the goalkeeper coach, slash second assistant. We talked about the team every morning. We talked about training. I sat in budget meetings with the owners, which was really quite interesting to start learning that side of stuff. And so it was very educational for me. You know, again, you're doing everything on a budget. And so you're trying to find ways to be as professional as you can, you know, whether it's with training facilities or gear or travel or meals or whatever, do as professional as you can. But obviously you're much more restricted than you would be in the MLS. So very educational. So I guess that's the best I can I give you on that answer. I know it was a long-winded one, but questions coming flying here.
George got something. George, go ahead, man.
John, being on the shorter side myself, I know from experience and looking at the modern-day goalkeeper, I mean, what would be your advice to that shorter goalkeeper? I mean, because you know there's that hiccup, man. They look at your size, and right away they're like, doesn't have the initial profile.
Yeah.
So I guess just, you know, from your experience, what would you share with those young aspiring shorter goalkeepers?
If you're good enough, you're tall enough. it's as simple as that. You know, if you're willing to work and you're good enough, then the sky's the limit. All you need is one person to give you the opportunity. I mean, I had so many people along the way, you know, that same thing. Starting from the time I was 15, maybe even a little, probably about 15, so the time I retired at 41, I still had people questioning my size. I'm 41 years old, and you're going, I've played over 500 games. Don't you guys think that I could do okay at this thing? You know, like, it's just the way people are. You know, and it doesn't mean that a tall guy is going to be better, you know, or tall lady is going to be better. You know, again, if you're good enough, you're good enough, you know, plain and simple.
Lotto, you had something?
Yeah, I want to go back to he had mentioned the path, which I appreciate. I was thinking about this last night, and I'll give you an idea where I came up with the question. So I was watching a little bit of the Kansas City Minnesota game, and Minnesota's playing on their third goalkeeper, Dane St. Clair, who played Georgia. He played for Sasho at Maryland.
Yeah, for Sasho.
And I really liked him. Like when he left, I'm like, yeah, he's not quite ready. Yep. You know, to be a number one, et cetera, et cetera. Johnny Pascarella was working with him at Minnesota, and we talked about that. John and I did. And pretty rare that a third goalkeeper is now playing in a conference final. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's done really well for himself over the last month.
Yeah.
But I think what I've seen is some of these young goalkeepers get drafted into the league. And then they just sort of disappear.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts on, I mean, obviously you took a different path, and you see the longevity where you see goalkeepers that come in, and I'm thinking, and would it be better for them to just not go into the league, just go into USL, USL one, whatever it is, get matches and build a ladder. What are your thoughts there on that? Cause it's interesting. The carousel in the MLS for goalkeepers.
That's a great question. That question I have addressed as many times as I can with young goalkeepers for many, many years. And I'll give you a few examples here, but you know, when I first started the MLS, it was an 18-man roster straight. Right. There was no developmentals this and, you know, designated here. It was like they had two goalies. You either made it or you didn't matter who you were, how old, that sort of thing. You know, so there was no reserve leagues. There was nothing, you know, it was either you made it or you went to USL, which, again, I thank Eric Vauder because he was the one that first said, you know, because all I thought was, I got to go to the MLS. And he's like, nope, you're going into the USL. You need games, you know. And then, like I said, once he broke it down in hockey terms for me, because I'm a big hockey guy, it made sense. You know, it made sense. Oh, I got to get my games. So when I do get the opportunity, I'll be ready. So my first For me, again, like I said, the first year I didn't get called up anywhere. But after that, I spent time in preseasons with pretty much any team, you know, Chicago, DC, Tampa Bay, Colorado, Dallas. Like I would go anywhere just to train and get in front of coaches. And then if somebody got injured, I would often get called up. So I'd go in on a Thursday night, train Friday, sit the bench Saturday, go back down to wherever I was playing on Sunday. So I'd always get a taste of it, you know, it kind of stoked the fire. But it wasn't until, like I said, until Greg Andrelis drafted me into Columbus where that was my full time, you know, my first real go at it. But by then I had over 100, I think it was close to 150 games in the USL. So he knew what he was getting, right? He knew he had even though I was still young, he knew he had a senior pro, even though nobody really knew about me back in the day. And
for people that don't know Greg was a goalkeeper as well.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yep. Greg was a goalkeeper and I just happened to know him from Matchnik camp since I was 15.
I was just about to mention it I just bumped into his brother and I worked with Greg a couple of years ago. It's fantastic. Yep.
Fantastic guy. And apparently he was keeping track of me. My last year in the ISL was playing Hershey and he had come out. I didn't realize it till afterwards, but he had come out and watched two or three of my games throughout the season and then ended up calling me and drafting me. But I've had this conversation for years with young goalkeepers when they go to the and I get the allure of the MLS. I mean, everybody wants to be at the top level, but if you are a young college kid, and I was actually just having this conversation the other morning with one of the pros that I'm training right now. And it's like, if you are, you know, a 2/3/4, whatever, somewhere in that ballpark, if you can get on their USL team, great. If they don't have a USL team, you need to have your agent somehow get you loaned somewhere. You know, you need to play games because the amount of times, just like you said earlier, was I've seen these guys, they're in 2 or 3 years. Oh, you didn't develop like the way we thought you would develop. You're out. Next young kid comes in and the cycle regurgitates every time. You know, I remember it's funny because I'm training Evan Newton now, who's the goalkeeper for Indy 11. And Evan and I actually go back, since I was playing in Virginia Beach when he was 10 years old, I used to train him. But for 3 years, he was out in San Jose with us, and he was our third.
Yeah.
I think it was 2 years. And then the third year comes up, and he's like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do, you know, I'll probably just sign again here. And I point blank said to him, you know, he was probably, I don't know, mid-20s, 25, 26. And I said to him, I said, don't take this the wrong way. I was like, you're a great kid. I'd love to have you back. I said, but if you come back next year, I said, you're going to start wasting your pro time. And I said, yeah, you get good training, but on Saturday, what do you, you know, maybe you dress, maybe you don't dress, you know, but you're never playing. He got one game, I think it was an international friendly in like 2 years being there. And I said, you're at the point in your career now where if you don't go play, you're not going to have a long career. And it was funny because I remember him kind of, I don't really want to go, you know. And then he went, and I think he played in maybe Phoenix or somewhere out there. And I remember him calling me as soon as the season ended. He goes, thank you very much for kicking me out. He goes, I forgot how fun it was. Forgot how fun it was to play, you know. And now you look at him now, right? I think he owns pretty much every goalkeeping record in the USL. You know, and he's been here for 2 years with Indy 11 and he's done great. You know, and it's funny because now the kid Jordan Farr, who's the backup for Evan, who's been here 3 years, I just had the same conversation with him the other day because I'm like he comes into our facility and I train him and I'm like, dude, you're good. Like you are good, but you've been here 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is, like you got to go on loan or you're not playing games, you know? And that's been going back to the original question. That's been going on for years. And I just think that it's obviously gotten better with the USL teams and all the reserve teams and all that. But sometimes I think that these kids, even though they say there's plans, sometimes there's not plans for these kids. It's just, you know, let's bring a kid in and let's hope he develops into it. Now, more and more of the clubs are actually have plans, right? And they understand it. But, you know, I still think it could be better. Correct.
It's interesting. I'm in Northern California, John. I'm north of San Francisco by about 50 miles. I'm up in Santa Rosa. So got a chance to always watch the Quakes play and, you know, been to some matches and watched, fortunate enough to watch you play. And, you know, you were sort of a consistent piece in that environment. It's been interesting since you left. It's been like this revolving goalkeeper game, yeah. You know, in San Jose between Tarbell, yeah. The kid that was at Clemson, and then yep. And Bingham, and now and then they brought in the guy who was I think he was Bingham. In Chicago. And then, you know, I don't know if he's injured or whatever. And Marcin Skalski's playing now. And it's just like, it's just been this crazy. Every time I turn a match on, I'm like, who the hell's playing now?
Yeah. 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 You know, one of the, and that was, I mean, I played 5 years there. That was where I played the most amount of games. But one of the, Jason Batty, who was the old goalie coach there, he's fantastic Kiwi. And, but he used to call me consistently boring.
Yeah.
I remember the first time he said that. And I was like,
Dawson.
I think that's a compliment, but I am not quite sure.
No, you from know, a Kiwi, that's a big compliment.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, actually, I like that. I'm cool with that. but it made sense once I really thought about it. You know, I just got into a groove out there, you know, and it was awesome. And like I said, and that's what you want. You want your goalkeepers to be consistently boring, occasionally make a big time save, but you don't want the up and downs, you know, and, you talk about San Jose, and I've known JT since he's 15 because he used to come train with us.
Yeah.
You know, he was in our youth academy. And I remember telling Chris Leach at the, who's in charge of the youth academy, I'm like, this kid's going to be a homegrown goalkeeper. He's that good. And he's like, he's 15. I'm like, trust me. You know, and I've been surprised that it took so long for them to actually give him a chance. You know, I was fortunate again to work with him. Jason Christ's first Olympic team camp when he brought JT in, and we went to Europe somewhere. You know, that's the first time I've worked with him since back in the day. And I mean, I think he's very good. And we go back to size. He's not a monster.
No, he's not big.
You know, he's probably maybe 6 foot, but he has it all. He can play with his feet. He's technically very good. Tactically, he reads the game. Like he's very high in my book. And, I still talk to him quite a bit. You know, we were actually chatting the other day. But yeah, I mean, I'm hoping for San Jose that he's the guy. You know, I really hope they give him the opportunity to run with it next year.
Good.
Cool. Jeff, what were you going to say?
Yeah, John. So a 21-year professional career, which is unbelievable to me. Did you ever find that you had to modify or change your style as you got older?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think a few different times, right? I think obviously, first and foremost, when the back pass rule came in, you know, because before that, we were, you know, picking it up, putting it down, picking it up, putting it down, you know, messing with the forwards, and they couldn't do anything. It was always fun for the goalkeepers. Yeah, exactly. So everybody had to, you know, you had to get used to being able to play now. As I got older physically, you know, age-wise, and then physically, you know, I couldn't cover as much distance off my line as I maybe did when I was younger. So that was, you know, I could still read things, but then I had to sometimes say, hey, you know what, that 22-year-old's probably going to beat me that ball. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and deal with it a little differently. So that was another one. But I think the third one, and this happened kind of late. It was more technical side of things, right? All of a sudden when dealing with breakaways, all these new techniques came out. And so some of these coaches started getting on this, you know, I call the block save the De Gea save. I call the spread one. I call that the Schmeichel, right? Like, because Casper does it and De Gea does the other one. So I remember Aaron Hyatt actually bringing in the De Gea save, when I got back to Chicago. And I remember Joe Cannon did the Schmeichel back in the day. We weren't really taught it, you know, it was just kind of like, I remember watching him and he did that quite a bit. You know, so it was interesting starting to change little techniques like that towards the end of my career as well, where, I remember trying to figure out the De Gea and dropping my knee and when would that work for me? And, oh, by the way, it's not just a technique that I need to pick up. It's also, I'm a little guy. So, you know, I drop a knee, all of a sudden I went from this big to that big, yeah. You know? So now I'm trying to figure out when to actually do that. Does it actually work for me or do I just need to put it to the side?
I think that's a really good point, John. And I just think we've discussed it a lot on this, and I think we're seeing the goalkeepers that are successful with it, or maybe they're not always successful with it, but are more successful than other ones. They're really big goalkeepers.
Yeah.
They're shookies, you know, they're 6'5" dudes that when they spread, they might get hit, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'd use Joe Hart because he was, you know, he was big and bulky. And, yeah. He got hit a lot. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Well, didn't go in, but yeah.
Yeah. You know. I try to teach my goalkeepers here, whether they're male or female, whether they're big or small, I give them the ideas of all the different styles, right? Because you think about when we grew up, it was either stand up or go down, right? You were either standing up on your toes and trying to react to a shot, or the ball was there, you know, and you went hands first, you put the long barrier behind it. Now you add all these other, you know, situations to it. I just try to tell them, like, first of all, you got to figure out what works for you and what doesn't. I'm just trying to give you as many tools as possible. It's like a golfer with their bag, right? You don't want them just using their driver and their putter, right? They got all these other clubs. And so for me, I'm trying to give all my goalkeepers more clubs in their bag. And then they figure out what works for me, you know, because again, some may like one thing. I've got a girl that I train and she's an absolute little stud. She's 14 years old and I actually can train her with pro goalkeepers. She's that good. But she, you know, she's taught from her, you know, from her goalkeeper coach, she likes the Schmeichel. She likes the spread, you know. Now she knows I'm not big on it because it opens up the area between your legs. But it, again, it works for her. So when she comes and trains with me and my goalkeepers, I'm not trying to change her. I make her think about things.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to change her because it works for her and she likes it, you know.
That's good because again, you're not cloning goalkeepers. You're training goalkeepers.
Yeah, we're all different.
Yeah, no, but the analogy with the golf bag is very good. I think it's very good, George.
Well, no, I'm also a big fan of providing the tools. Yeah, I believe that, you know, a number of people want success, but success is a byproduct, and you got to provide them the skills for them to be able to get to become successful. So I think providing them the skills is first and foremost. And then having the open-mindedness and not just, hey, do as I say, to be like, hey, you got to be able to figure this out. I think that's where we can empower goalkeepers as well. But John, to go back to what you were saying, I thought was really insightful was that you needed to figure out what worked for you. And you were exposed, but just like us, and I think you're getting some traditional guys here that, you know, again, keep your feet, try to read it, or eventually go down. What was the outcome when you were in that environment and you had to figure it out? Did you figure out what you felt like was best for you?
Yeah, I did. But, you know, again, I spent and people who have been around me know this. I spent a lot of extra time on the field, you know, and not doing very sophisticated drills, you know, it's very simple stuff. If I felt like I wasn't sharp on breakaways, I would literally have one of the assistant coaches keep a couple of the boys and he just knock a ball out to them and they dribble in, you know, and I would just figure, I would try stuff, you know, okay, can I close and stand up? Can I close and go? Can I close, you know, can I do a block save in that? And, you know, I just tried things, you know, and to figure it out. And for me, again, most of the time, even in my late in my career, it was either because I was still quick enough reaction wise, it was I'll close, but I'll stand up and then I'll react. It might be a foot, it might be a hand, or if the ball's there to be won, I'm going down. You know, I very rarely, you know, did a block save or did a Schmeichel, did a spread, unless I was, you know, just trying to throw something at it to, you know, to get in the way of it kind of thing.
Well, I think that's good because one of the things that I think a lot of coaches lack is allowing people to try things. Because again, if you're going to try things, that means some stuff is not going to work as well.
Yeah.
And so are we okay with stuff not working well for you, but you learn versus, okay, do this. Cause I know what happens here. I know what happens here. Instead, allowing that learning to go on. And that learning means that there's going to be times where you go, you know what, this doesn't work at all. So I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
George, Ed.
Well, it's creating that, I guess, a positive coaching environment or, you know, that goalkeeping environment, because the reality is as goalkeepers, we know that one mistake results in a goal.
Yeah.
So it's tough to change that mentality of like, hey, I'm going to try this. And if I give up a goal, no big deal, because it was always a big deal.
It's always
a big deal. So, you know, to find that comfortable space where you're encouraging goalkeepers, like, hey, listen, trial and error is okay. Trial and error is okay, especially in this environment. I'm going to be okay with it. Because I don't think a lot of goalkeepers are hearing that.
No.
Because of the fact that, hey, we're conceding goals. We're losing this game. You know what I mean? So I think the environment that we create, and obviously, again, I think the old school mentality versus a new school mentality, whatever that is, because that's going to be tough to define too.
Yeah.
George, to your point, though, I think one of the problems is, and again, if you look at youth sport in general, the ratio of trainings to games has changed. Yeah. They play so many games, and it's important. You know what? I don't care. It's a game. I don't want to give up a goal. I'm not going to experiment in a game.
Yeah.
In training, I will experiment. And that's why we need much more quality training. And we can reduce the number of games for a developing player.
Yeah.
John, there's one thing that you talked about earlier. And this is, I'm always very interested in this, though, is reading the game and having kids learn to read the game. And I forget, somebody, one of you guys will remind me, somebody who said they're not so much a goalkeeper coach, but they're a goalkeeper whisperer. And I thought, you know what? That's
G. Guerrero.
That was G.
Was it G? Yeah, it was G. And I'm much more of a goalkeeper whisperer, where I have these kind of conversations with, you know, I'm primarily college goalkeepers, just saying, okay, what could you have done there? What do you think is going to happen? Those kind of conversations.
Yeah.
How do you go about training your kids to read the game?
Again, in the club environment, it's easier, right? Because I have somewhere around 45 to 50 minutes with them in just a goalkeeper environment. And then we send them right to their teams. And then I have another 45 minutes where I'm walking around and I'm in that environment with them. And the same with the college, you know. So I'm there and we're talking and we're, you know, and I'll stand behind each one of them for 5 or 10 minutes in the goal. And I'll watch what they watch. And, you know, there might be times where I'm like, do you think you're high enough? Do you think you're too deep? You know, I try to throw a lot out of questions. You know, I want them to think rather than just like, hey, John Bush said I have to do it this way, you know, because I don't, again, that's force feeding, you know, like I want them to be able to think the game, you know, and what did you see there? Why did you do this? Or, you know, that sort of thing. I want them thinking about the game. You know, obviously in just like what we're doing now when the off season is, it's a little bit tougher when we're just kind of goalkeeper training without the team environment, but we get pretty live in the building. We get pretty, you know, active once we get into it. And for me, what I like to do with that is, you know, especially for my older group, that's good enough when I put them with the pros on a Sunday night, like, I think it's cool to see because one, like they all raise their game because they're like, oh my gosh, I got a couple pros in here. You know, they don't want to embarrass themselves, you know, but on the other side of that is like, they're seeing what that next level is, you know, because I've got kids that want that aspiration, you know? And so now they're seeing these USL guys training and they're watching how mentally into the drill they're doing. And then all of a sudden, as we all know, like, you know, you go for a water break or whatever, and they're joking around and they're giggling. And, but as soon as boom, it's like, they're locked back in. And now the attention to detail, you know, especially when we get live, when we're, you know, you're getting a ball and you're distributing over here and you're coming for a shot over here, you're getting a volley where we're moving them around a lot. I think that's them, you know, figuring out the mental side of it and the tactical side. You know, I think it's a combination. You know, how many times have we seen goalkeepers that are just freaks of nature, right? And they're so athletic and they save shots and they do, you know, all this unbelievable stuff. But when you ask them to think the game or read the game, it's like sometimes the electricity doesn't connect, right? And the light bulb doesn't go off and you're sitting there going like, what is he seeing or she seeing or not seeing? You know, I've had a few of those. So, you know, for me, again, I just try to make it as interactive as I can and I ask them questions because I want them thinking about it, not just regurgitating some answer I gave them.
No, that's great. That's great. Again, I've done the same thing. And, you know, what were you thinking? And, you know, the funniest answer I got was, I wasn't.
Yes.
So, yeah, that, a lot. Like, no. Yeah, that ain't going to work. So, Lotto, did you have something?
Yeah, before I wanted to go back, he made a good point, and it relates to sort of a little bit what we were talking about before we started recording. We're like, we should record some of this. he made the comment about, and I think we're probably all a little bit like this, and I know George was because I coached George, but John had mentioned that he spent more time on the field than probably people realized, extra time on the field, yeah. If you want to call it that, but that's just investment in your craft. And I related to, I'm still training some goalkeepers, not as maybe as much as Shuki is. But just because I love it still. Mm-hmm. And I only have in the club that I'm working with, I only have, I believe, one goalkeeper that says, can you stay a little bit extra? What can I do extra? Can you help me with, I'm thinking about plyometrics. Sure. Let's meet early. I gave him a plyometric program. It's in 6-week blocks. And I mean, one goalkeeper in an entire club that we work with that thinks that way. And you had mentioned beforehand, what we all talked about, we were just, everything is so structured nowadays, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and that we just don't see as much as kids just going out and playing on their own and training on their own. And it's just without anybody there to say, do it this way, do it that way. You know, what do you reflect on that a little bit? And, you know, maybe on what we talked about or what we were talking about before we actually started recording.
Yeah, no, I mean, for me, it started, you know, I have an older brother who was a striker. So when we lived in Virginia, he built a goal out of 2x4s in the backyard. And he just put me in the back and just, you know, beat the crap out of me, shoot balls at me all day. And that's literally how it started for me. I mean, I would play for a youth club. I think we practiced twice a week back then, you know, there was no goalie training or anything like that. You figured it out. I would go to his high school practices. I would watch the goalie play for them and try to figure out what he did and try to emulate that in the backyard, you know. And then from there, it just kind of really started growing, you know. And it was like, for whatever reason, I wanted to do more and more. You know, I started working out on my own. I started, you know, then we moved to Pennsylvania, the church that my dad worked in, they had a gym, you know, a wood floor gym. And I come home from school and I would literally just take a couple of balls and I would take my gloves and everything. And I would just kick against the wall for hours. And then dad would walk in and be like, hey, it's dinner time. Okay. We go to the house. I don't know why I did it. I never felt like it was work. I never like felt like it was a chore. I wanted to do it. You know, and I remember when I started learning about plyometrics back in the day, you know, through Matchnick, and you know, I knew I was going to be short. Like I knew I wasn't going to grow. So, okay, I need to do this. And I used to set up paint cans in our basement, and I used to go down there 3 nights a week for 30 minutes. And I would do different footwork patterns, whether it was jumping, whether it was forward shuffling, side shuffling, I just make things up, you know, and I would just, I know I need this. I don't know. I don't know the, you know, the proper, all the stuff that, well, you know, you got to work this amount and you got to do this and all the stuff that we have now with, you know, tracking everything. I mean, that didn't exist. It was just like, I need to jump. So what do I need? I need to jump more. You know, I need to practice jumping. you know, that's how it was. And, you know, I moved up to Albany and again, same thing. You know, by then I thought, okay, I'm halfway decent at this thing. I've just finished with the under 17s. And I remember just, we had a kickback board, luckily at the high school. You know, and if I couldn't beg Jeff Gwynn back in the day to come out and shoot on me, I would literally just go out and kick on the wall if nobody else would come over, and I'd kick on the wall, and I knew when the last bus left. The last bus left at like 5:45. And I remember like there were days where I'd be like, all right, just one more rep. And I'd be running to chase the last bus, you know, before it left the school. But I like, that's what I wanted to do. You know, so it's just, but I think it was different then. As you guys said, like, it's so much more structured now. The seasons are so much longer, especially when you're at the, you know, the MLS next or the DA level and all those levels. They train a lot more, you know, so I think that's all a combination of maybe why these kids don't want to do as much on their own. But I also think, I hate to say it, you know, like I think sometimes, you know, the time we live in, they're a little bit lazy, you know, without being mean. I'm not trying to be mean to them, but
it's just an observation.
Yeah. It's an observation, you know? And I've told my kids here all the time, I'm like, there's always more you can do, you know, and it's as simple, you don't have to kill yourself every session, you know, but you know, one of the things when I went to Charlotte, I couldn't play with my right foot to save my life, you know, and I remember the first preseason game, the ball came to my right and I tried to play with the outside of my left foot and Frank Holmstein went bananas. So after the game, he walks by me and he's like, where are you going? And I said, following the boys in the locker room. Game's over. We won. He drops two bags of balls and he says, I want 150 balls after practice every day.
Oh, nice.
So you can kick with your right foot. And I thought he was joking. And I looked at him. I looked at EB. Yeah. I realized they weren't joking. So every day I would just after practice, and it, you know, it wasn't intense. It wasn't, I just put one ball down, kick it down the field, take the next ball down, kick it down the field. And I walk down and I kick them back. So I did 150 each day. Just little things like that, you know, where, you know, I think sometimes now because the kids are always on their phones, you know, and that plays into, we didn't, you know, obviously we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have apps, we didn't have any of that stuff. So you went out and you did stuff. But I always think there's things to do, you know, and ways to get better. Especially the other part of that too, is especially now with the amount of technology and game analysis there is, you know, and that's something going back to what you were asking earlier, Bill, like I spend a lot of time with our kids with game analysis. We tape every game, you know, so I'll send them clips. I'll cut their clips and I'll send them to them or I'll ask them to watch and send me clips that they think they did well on and what they can improve on. So again, I'm making them think, but that's just another avenue to say, hey, you know what? Real Madrid play this weekend. Let me watch their game. Let me watch Courtois. Let me, you know, whoever you like, right? There's always games on TV now, and that could be part of getting better.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things you said that were very good, John. You know, especially the idea about free play. And again, obviously now I'm much more into the academic side of things, and this concept of free play and deliberate play, because Erickson's deliberate practice, that's a big topic, but the deliberate play now is when kids play independently, there's a lot more at stake because it's independent. It's not for the parents, it's not for anybody else, it's just for us playing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finding a way to get that back so that kids can do this and do the things you've talked about. First off, it depends on, you know, the commitment level. It's not every kid's going to want to do that. That's fine.
Agreed.
You're not going to do that. That's fine. But I mean, I would be, you know, just as you said, you know, I'd be up on the third floor at Albany State in that wrestling room.
Yeah.
And Offram or Chris Waterbury is shooting on me at nights in February because, you know, can't be outside.
Yeah.
I remember Tony, the janitor, kicking us out at 11 o'clock, saying, like, no, and I ain't staying around. I'm going home. You guys got to get out. And, you know, doing things like that. Nowadays, with all the structure, kids don't have that responsibility. Mm-hmm. The training is arranged, the training is scheduled, and things like that. And how do we give them the responsibility for their own, you know, careers?
Yeah.
Potentially careers. We need you to take responsibility for your career. And again, I sound like an old guy, but you know what? I am an old guy. So what? I don't care. George, go ahead. Interrupt me before I get on a real rant.
Rants are good, Bill.
I raised my hand. I mean, I didn't interrupt.
Rants are good.
John, two-part question, but they're really tied together. My earlier influences, because when I was youngster, we only had soccer made in Germany, so I gravitated to the Bundesliga, and I can just remember always wanting to emulate, you know, Sepp Maier. So one, I'd like to know who your earlier influences were as goalkeepers. And secondly, you mentioned, you know, Greg Andrulis. I'm sure you had other goalkeepers, coaches along the way. Takeaways that have helped shape you and mold you into the person and goalkeeper that you are today.
Yeah. All right. So first question, I think in the early days, because I don't think we really knew many other goalkeepers, it was Tony Miola. I think it was probably everybody's, you know, my age, because I remember first meeting him when I was, again, I was 14, 15 with the youth 17s, and he came to Ryder, New Jersey, you know, for a regional camp. and we were there. And I mean, it was like God walked in the building. He drove in his Porsche, blaring Guns N' Roses. I remember everything about that day. You know, he had his rat tail down. I mean, I've teased him for years about it. But it was like everybody looked up to Tony. You know, that was right when he left UVA. He was the man. Like, you know, so it started with Tony. You know, then Peter Miller actually turned me on to Shea Given, who used to play for Newcastle and then went to City. And he told me, he goes, you need to watch this guy because you play very similar to him and he's not a big goalkeeper. And so then I really started watching everything I could find about Shea. And trying to emulate his game. So from there, it was, once I got into the national team setup, I was around Casey quite a bit. Now obviously Casey and I are two different goalkeepers. But I really liked the way he did his business. There was no nonsense. There was not a lot of fluff to him. But he not only was he fantastic in the games, but in trainings, it was like, I remember playing 4v4s against him with guys like McBride and Claudio, and like they couldn't score on him. And I'm in the other goal going, like, we can't score. This is crazy. It's 4v4, you know, like, so I started really watching what he did, you know, and that was, again, that was when he was over in England. And then he came obviously back to the States and played in Seattle. So I had a few different people. That I, you know, it kind of changed over my years, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
So that was the player. So as far as coaches, again, so many of them, right? Because as long as you have an open mind, you're going to take something, you know, whether it's good or bad, you're going to take something from each coach you deal with. And for me, I've said this, and I'll say it till the day I die, Eric Vauder is God as far as everything in my world. And, you know, I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, he's so much more than a goalkeeper coach. He started as a goalkeeper coach for me. And we had our tough days. I mean, he tells some crazy stories and I won't get into those, but, you know, now, like I said, he's basically my second father. I talk to him almost every day of the week. But he taught me goalkeeping. He taught me life, you know, and for me, you know, that's the guy I wanted to emulate, because it's not only about how many professional goalkeepers and how many quality college goalkeepers and all that's come. It's the human beings that he's helped develop, you know, and there's guys that aren't even in the soccer world that are in our little goalkeeping world that we have that he's kind of developed here. And they're successful in whatever they do. One's a lawyer, one works for Adobe. Like, they're just, and they're all down to earth, very respectful, do things the right way. And that I think all came from EB. You know, so he's at the top of my charts. Outside of that, you know, again, there were so many, you know, I look at John Murphy in my early days in Columbus, you know,
Murph.
You know, Murph, fantastic guy. I look at Daryl Shore in my Chicago days when we had a really good team and I was goalkeeper of the year. You know, Jason Batty in San Jose, Phil Wedden with the national teams. I took something from everybody, you know. So I was very blessed to be able to have those times and learn. And again, and Bill said it earlier, it's like you have to be willing to learn and you have to be willing to try things and you have to have an open mind. And again, you're not always – there's one or two that, I won't call my names, but great goalkeeper coaches, but – I actually learned what not to do from them, you know, because there were bits and pieces about the way they handled their business I didn't like, you know, and I remember saying to myself, like, if I ever get in that situation, that's what I don't want to do, you know?
Yeah, that's a good. Couple things, you know, you touched on the things you touched on, especially with Eric, are just, that's the quality of a good coach. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people come into coaches, and that's the impact that a good coach can have, you know, not only on the player, but on the person. So that's good. And I'm not offended because you didn't say the Albany Capitals.
Sorry. My apologies.
No, I'm gonna end this. Where's the button? I'm going to hit a button. Lotto, I thought you had something for John.
This is not so much a question, but an appreciation for what he said. And I think this is important for coaches and goalkeepers. And I want to at least paraphrase it. He talked about, you know, having goalkeepers we idolize or that we look up to, that we want to frame ourselves after. And for someone to be smart enough to say, Bushy, start watching Shea Given because you are a lot like him, because it's either frame size, physical characteristics. I think that's really important. And I've thought about that, and I maybe need to think about that a little bit more, generally speaking, with any player. Because if you want to play like Courtois or like Lloris, or you want to play like De Gea, whomever it is, and you're not going to be bigger than 5'11", 6 foot, then stop trying to play like Shooky, man. Like it's not you. Now, maybe there are things you can learn from them, and also vice versa. If you're a 6'5" guy, to be honest with you, maybe it's the opposite. You can probably learn better footwork by watching John Bush. You can probably learn better work ethic of plyometrics by being like, what does John do? How does John approach high balls? It makes the big goalkeeper better. So maybe retroactively, it's a little different. And the second thing, talking about coaches and experience. And I just heard this in a conversation I had in a different kind of coaching world that I'm involved with. And we talked about coaches, and this was an elite athlete evolving through different coaches over his long pro career, endurance athlete. And I really appreciate what he said. He said, hey, every time I've moved on from coach to coach, he goes, I didn't ever want to look at it like, I don't like you anymore, but it's like, I need to move on and I need to evolve. And he thought about it as every time you move on, it's like you get a degree. Like in education, we get degrees.
Yeah.
High school diploma, associate's degree, bachelor's degree, whatever. Every time you move on from a coach, it's like you've got a new degree. Mm-hmm. At some point you're tapped out. Like you can't keep taking the same course anymore. You've got to have different courses, you know, unless you have someone that's diverse, that you can do that. Maybe in goalkeeping you can, but I really like that. Move on from one coach, take everything you can, move on to the next coach, and keep refining your skills as you go. So I appreciate that. And I hope everyone out there understands that as well, because I think that's pretty important in the learning process.
Yeah, good, Leonard, man. Jeff, did you have something?
Yeah, I got a softball question for you.
Oh, boy.
Toss it up, Chucky.
He doesn't play softball.
Most dangerous attacker you played against and your favorite center back to play behind.
Oh, good one.
You think those are softball questions. Those are not softball questions after so many years.
Chucky, this is a fastball, man. This is coming in hot.
Golly.
Change up.
Don't worry about offending anybody.
No, I have to go with a few different strikers to start because of different reasons, and I'll explain why. So Peter Novak, number one, was the fastest person I've ever seen with the ball at his feet. So when we would play small-sided games and he would come at me, I did not know what to do. Do I come out? Do I stay down? Do I go up? Do I go down? It happened so fast, I was confused. Like, I have never seen somebody go that fast. And I would just remember, like, and I was young too. I just remember going, like, what do I do? Oh, crap. What do I do? Yep. Go. Yeah. I don't know. You know? So I put Peter in there. Brian McBride, one of the best finishers I've ever been around. And not necessarily because he could beat you many different ways. He had enough power, but it wasn't like he had a cannon. But he never missed a goal. When we would do shooting, you know, whether it was in Columbus in the early days or even Chicago in the late days before he retired, like, we would do extra shooting, he never missed a goal. He made you work every shot. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember Echeverry. He was so, you know, he was so tricky. He was so, you know, again, my early days. So I bring back names that people are like, who was that? Like, yeah, a little bit old. You know, Wondolowski. Probably had the best nose for the goal I've ever seen. He just always knew where to be. You know, he can hit a ball with both feet, you know, relatively well, no issues there, but just always had a nose where to be in the right time. You know, and he was such a competitor, he is such a competitor. You know, he hated to lose. And that was part of the reason those years in San Jose, we had, you know, we didn't have a abundance of talent, but we had guys who didn't want to lose, and it happened. I mean, there were fights on Tuesday morning in sports because nobody wanted to lose. You know,
but it was fun to watch some of those matches, Bushy, just because of that. You guys scored some goals in the death so many times.
Think about those guys. Alan Gordon, Len Hart, Wondolowski, you know, just like, you know, it was awesome. It was awesome. As far as center backs, God, again, there were so many. My early days in Columbus, I remember when Robin Fraser came towards the end of his career. Ooh, such a great brain on him.
Unbelievable.
You know, his legs were starting to go, but, you know, such a great brain. And what Greg did, Greg was very smart. He put two young kids around him. We played a 3-5-2. So, you know, Robin was the brains, and Chad Marshall and Chris Wingert were the workhorses. And, you know, Chad was fresh. Actually, I think both of them were rookies. But Chad just became an absolutely beast, could dominate from the beginning, and him and I were roommates. So I got to see it from day one with him. He dominated Brian McBride, and I've never seen that before. Chad was another one. Obviously we know what he did in Seattle when he got sent there. Chicago, I look back at my Chicago time, hands down, CJ Brown, hands down. Hard as nails. Yeah, can't really pass the ball worth shit. He'll tell you. But he'll point blank tell you, don't pass me the ball unless I got like 20 yards. You know? But when you wanted somebody marked out of the – like he took pride in marking somebody out. He didn't want the ball. He's not one of – like in today's world where they're all flashy and I want to spread it. No, he didn't care about the ball. He wanted to defend the proper way. And him and I still talk –
he just turned it into like 9v9 on the field. Like, don't get the ball, and my dude ain't getting the ball.
Yes, that's all he cared about. That's all he cared about.
It's so good.
I love that. Know your role and shut it down.
There you go. Stay in your lane.
And he loved it. He was okay with it. So I had him. Let's see. When we went to when I went to San Jose, Jason Hernandez and Clarence Goodson, when Clarence came in. Jason, you know, another Jersey boy, again, very similar to CJ, just more athletic. Like, he was okay with the ball at his feet. He thought he was great in 5v2, but it wasn't. but he was good enough. But his thing was he loved blocking shots. And he would actually lay down like a hockey player, and most of the time it hit him in the back. And like, we would tease him after every game. We're like, if you were an indoor player, you would make so much bonus money on the amount of block shots you had, because you literally block. He was unbelievable. He was fast, so he had the pace to recover. And then Clarence, when Clarence came, again, such a good brain on him. Still had a little pace in his legs, so he had a little bit of combo there, but. He thought the game very well. And so he had a great brain. I'll throw one back at you. Best captain I ever played for, hands down, not even a question, Chris Armas. I played for McBride, Mazenhoff, who's one of my best friends in the world. You know, CJ Brown was the captain, you know, I was under. Hands down, Chris Armas. Put it this way, to this day, when we talk on the phone, I still call him Cap.
Nice.
You talk about an honest guy who would hold not only himself accountable, but every player in that locker room, and not do it in a bad way. But if you weren't quite at your best, the arm comes around the shoulder. What do you think about today's training? And you didn't want to let him down. You felt terrible when, like, crap, here comes Christy to my locker. Like, maybe I didn't do good today, you know? But hands down, the best captain I've ever played for.
That's awesome.
Hey, Georgie, cool. did you ever play, or did we play against Armas when he was at Adelphi? Because we played Adelphi, didn't we?
I don't know. Remember? If we played Adelphi, man.
We played him. We played him, yeah, I think, one year, yeah. The year where Chris Love
remember? That's right, at our tournament. I think that was at our tournament, too.
I just
that's
don't remember right. if Armas was playing then. But
yeah, I don't know if he was.
Good player, man. Right? Really good dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Met him a few times when he was coaching, too. He was coaching the women over at Adelphi, to be a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he got into with the Red Bulls again. So
diversified.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he did exceptional as a coach too.
Yeah. So he, you know, when he retired, a lot of people don't know how bad his hip was that last year. Like his hip, I mean, there'd be days we'd be walking out the training field and he couldn't even bend his leg. Like he'd just be like dragging it, but he never complained. And then every Thursday he'd get a shot. Every Thursday after training, he'd get a shot and be ready to go on Saturday. And then you see him Monday, Tuesday, and you're like, good God, this poor guy. But he never said anything, just got on with it. You know, so when he retired, he stayed, I think it was 1 year, and he was one of the assistant coaches one of my last years in Chicago. And it was awesome. It was great having him because, he was still kind of a little bit in between because there were a lot of us that would go talk to him, and then he could, relate to the coaches, to Dennis and those guys. But he's from Long Island. His wife's from Long Island. And I think eventually that just, they wanted to go home. I wish he would have stayed. I wish it would have been because I think he would have. I think eventually he would have become the head coach in Chicago. And I don't think Chicago would be in the predicament they are in now if they would have kind of stayed in that, direction. But who am I to say?
Yeah. Interesting. John, again, we talked quite a bit on your stature, your height. And was there thing, and you mentioned the plyometrics, and I thought that was great because I did that as well. But was there any particular type of training that you did then that you do with your kids now to especially help them with flighted balls?
Again, I just, we go over the basics on how to catch a high ball and do all that stuff like everybody does. And then it's about going in and dealing with crosses, right? And at first it might be with no pressure or with, maybe one person just in and around. And then when they get comfortable with that, it's from different angles and now you're adding people in and now you're getting a little bit of, hey, let's bump them, let's get some contact in there, especially when you're smaller. I mean, I give you a perfect example. When I went from the US, USISL into MLS, in the USISL, there weren't many guys bending balls, right? Everything was floated. Everything, for me, as long as I got my feet going, no problem. Right. I could get there and I was claiming balls 14, 15, 16 yards off. You get to the MLS and all of a sudden, balls are bent and balls are swinging and they're dipping and they're diving. And I remember, Andrulis, he had a drill and it wasn't very fancy, but once to twice a week, he, at the end of training, he'd put servers, up top on each corner, 30 yards out, lumping balls in wide, lumping balls in. And he put four or five guys around me and he just tell them, hit them. Just hit them, make them get used to getting hit.
Yeah.
And I mean, there were days where, again, big boys coming in and keeper, bam, and he's like, this is what's going to happen. You need to get used to this and you need to figure out what you can catch and what you have to box. And again, it's not fancy, but it was the way it was. And it was like, I had to adapt my game to now figure out, okay, that was a ball last year in the USISL I could catch above somebody. Now I can't catch it. Now I have to figure out where I'm boxing it and how I'm boxing it. Little things like that. So we do a lot of stuff like that. I gradually try to build their confidence, right? This is how it kind of should look when you're catching a high ball. Now it's going to be a little different. Now you get runners involved and now you get this. But again, I want you to figure out what your range is, when there's nobody around, but then also what your range is when we add defenders and when we add forwards coming in, because as we all know in this, coaches, that changes, right? You add players in front of you and all of a sudden your eyes are not just on the ball, but now you're seeing runners coming around you. And it takes your attention sometimes off that ball.
Yeah. There's a ton to be said for repetition. But especially altering the conditions and, again, providing thoughts and feedback.
Yeah.
Cool. Good. Fellas, anything else for John? This has been great. It's been a very fun, hour and 15 minutes, whatever it's been. But other thoughts for John?
I'm good.
All right.
John, I just want to say thank you, man. I mean, very insightful. And I think not only for players, but for coaches and goalkeeper coaches, man, your time was awesome. So thanks again.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. I love talking goalkeeping.
I said I wanted to go back and talk about gloves. So a good chance for you, yeah. Bushy, to maybe plug your company a little bit.
Okay.
But also we've had discussions a little bit offline about gloves and different companies and, you know, just the technologies and things. And I know it's part of your mission with that company is you see a lot of gloves now and some gloves that I believe are ridiculously overpriced. That kids are buying, and finally, like, they come to me and my other assistant with my goalkeeping program, and they're like, "Hey, you know, what are the gloves you guys are wearing?" And I'll plug them. But I've been using RG gloves for a couple of years. Just I'm like, I don't know how I stumbled onto them, but I know the guy who's distributing them in the U.S. He said, "Hey, can you send me a couple pairs? Let me try them." And I'm like, and I was floored at the quality of them and the price of them relative to. You know, I'd put one on one hand and I'd put a kid who's got a Nike and Adidas, a Royce that's a high dollar glove on the other hand. And I'm like, it's almost no difference, but they're double the price. So anyway, with that in mind, talk a little bit about HPG and sort of your process with that.
Yeah. So we've been around almost 10 years now.
And it started with just you basically.
Yeah.
It's wearing them. In MLS.
Yeah, started with me when I was playing in San Jose. At that time, I had a business partner who actually technically started up in Canada, but he knew nothing about soccer. He was a parent that got tired of overpaying for gloves and, you know, decided to start a company, but didn't know. And through a mutual friend, through mutual goalkeeper coach, we got connected. And then he basically said, look, I don't know what I'm doing. You design, you develop everything and, you know, I'll be your partner. And that's, you know, simple as that. It kind of worked out. And then I spent 4 or 5 months really designing and starting to expand a little bit of our of what we had, because he only had a couple gloves out. And then over the years, we've just kind of kept going. And, you know, I'm not getting too crazy in the apparel stuff. I prefer to stay in my lane as far as gloves. And, you know, but the couple things that I like to say is, one, you know, they are top quality. They are made in the same factories as all the big companies are. Yeah,
that was a question I have for you.
You know, they're all made in the same places now. You know, back in the day when we were young, right, they all came out of Germany. And that was like the only place. So, you know, but now there's so many other factories throughout the world that make the gloves, and they make quality gloves. Like you said, there are so many small companies now that, you know, that are around that make a quality glove. Because I think we're all using the same couple factories. You know, but for me, I think two of the things that I always like to say about HPG is, well, three things. One, we've been around 9 years. We're not going anywhere. Two, every glove and everything we make, whether it's the pants, the glove bags, I have personally designed and I personally developed it and I personally tried it. All right. Good. So I've worn literally every product we have. And so that I like to say, you know, I'm not here peddling something. This is my company, right? So I develop it, I design it. And the John Bush gloves, whether you look at the white ones or the black and green ones, those are the same exact gloves I played with the last 9 years of my career. Like I could literally go into the warehouse, take one pair out of my size and put them on. Right. So it's not some of these companies where they, you know, the top looks the same, but the palms are different. It's the same. It's the same exact glove that I wear because I want to make sure these kids have the opportunity to wear a quality glove, but at an affordable price where it's, you know, because these kids, you know, or not the kids necessarily, but the parents, you know, they spend a lot of money on these gloves, you know, you know, probably 10 to 15, 20 pairs, depending on at what level they play a year. And you think about it, if you're a $150 pair of gloves, that's a lot of money. You can basically get two of mine, a training pair and a game pair, for the same amount you get one of the pairs for the big companies.
Right. And that's what I've said to the kids. You know, I talk about Ziggy's gloves with RG. It's the same thing. I go, you can get two high quality match gloves for the same price you're getting one pair of match gloves. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can check us out on social media at HPG_GK. So come check us out and you'll see training videos of me with the pros and all my kids here. You'll see all kinds of stuff.
Cool. Very good. John, it's been a great, whatever, however long it's been, but No, it was great to catch up. Great to hear your stories and how that can, I think that'll really be interesting for, especially for young goalkeepers, but also for goalkeeping coaches to hear some of your ideas. Cause I think you got some very sound ideas regarding coaching.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good. So. Good. All right.
All right, guys.
Good. Thank you for listening. Here we go.
Bye, Bushy. Thank you, man.
Later, guys. See ya.
We hope you enjoyed that episode at the Goalkeeper Roundtable. If you'd like to reach out with suggestions, comments, or questions, all of our email addresses are available in the show description. If you like the show, we'd love for you to subscribe to it, but also share it in social media platforms or with any other goalkeeper or coach who may find value in it. We hope you turn in to the next Goalkeeper Roundtable.